Okay, good evening everyone, and welcome to the third seminar of the Oxford Islam and Justice Programme. My name is Jacob Williams. I am a DPhil student in political theory, researching religious philosophical critiques of liberalism. I'm one of the conveners of the seminar series. I'm going to shortly introduce our speaker for today, Dr. Mohammed Alekbi. Before that, I'm going to say a few words about the wider purpose of the seminar series, and I should also extend our thanks to Dr. Rehan Ismail and the Contemporary Islamic Studies Centre here at the Middle East Centre at St. Anthony's, who have made the event possible. As this is our third seminar this term, some of you may already know that our aim is to stimulate reflection on the problems faced by Islamic political thought in the unprecedented and previously unimaginable social and political conditions of the modern world. And in particular, for Muslims who live under the broadly liberal political regimes of the West, we suspect that regarding these regimes as representing a pragmatic compromise, a modus vivendi with more authentic Islamic values, is, among other issues, not a sufficient basis for practical imperatives for Muslims, like claiming rights against hostile or Islamophobic political actors, because this attitude leaves Muslims open to the accusation of accepting liberal ground rules only pragmatically and conditionally, and therefore leaves Muslims without an obvious compelling response to that accusation. Now, our previous seminars, led by Dr. Mohammed Fadl and Dr. Raymond Harvey, respectively, explored the question of the Islamic intellectual tradition's relationship to liberalism, namely whether it can endorse the universal and equal civil and religious freedoms and a state that is neutral between religions as an ideal rather than a compromise, and also the question of the Islamic tradition's relationship to the idea of natural law, a universal morality knowable independently of revelation but grounded in divine wisdom. The question today of the role of fiqh, the body of legal precepts derived from the Quran and the sayings of the Prophet, is of particular relevance to contemporary questions about the pursuit of justice. While so-called fiqh maximalism would hold that the state has little room for discretion or political choice beyond the domain of revealed law, other perspectives, as we'll shortly see, would view other kinds of legal reasoning as potentially authentically or normatively Islamic as well, and thereby potentially allowing greater adaptation of Muslim conceptions of justice to contemporary circumstances. We are greatly honoured today to be addressed on this topic by Dr. Mohammed Alekbi, a research fellow at the Oxford Centre for Islamic Studies. He specialises in the law and governance of the Muslim world in late antiquity and the Middle Ages. Dr. Alekbi will speak for about 45 minutes. We will then open up to questions and we'll finish before 8 p.m. And we encourage you all to share your ideas and perspectives, and we look forward to a stimulating conversation. So please welcome Dr. Mohammed Alekbi.
Thank you so much, Jacob, and Mustafa, and Rehan Ismail, and the Middle Eastern Studies Center for inviting me to give this talk. So today I want to present an alternative legal history of Islamic law. Between the 11th and 12th centuries, rulers, military elites, viziers, and even judges declared that there existed an Islamic law other than fiqh, siyasa, which I call governmental law. In their books, both titled Al-Hakama Sultaniya by Abbasid Buya judges Al-Mawardi and Abu Ya'la, they declare that the military administrative courts of law adhere to siyasa, unlike the judiciary. These works were the earliest administrative legal writings available to historians of Islamic law throughout the 20th century. Historians of Islamic law, such as Emil Tayen, declared that siyasa was the other of fiqh, arbitrary, extraordinary, and extra-legal. Echoing these sentiments, Wael Hallaq states that fiqh is the true Islamic law, and anything outside of it is not true Islamic law, is more Islamic culture. But I want to take an alternative approach to the ones taken by my colleagues, that I consider siyasa as a branch of Islamic law, much more sophisticated. It's made up of military and bureaucratic norms, procedures, rationales, and discretionary authority. So what's the so what question for this? Why should we study siyasa? There's multiple reasons. Later governmental legal codes, such as the Ottoman Qanun, were based on the formation of siyasa. Khad Fahmi notes that in his quest for justice, that siyasa courts continued to exist until the end of the 19th century alongside Sharia courts. At the same time, such a question exposes what is Islamic law? What does it constitute? It provides a nuanced and pluralistic understanding of Islamic law beyond fiqh maximalism. So this talk is divided into three periods, just like the first three chapters of my upcoming book monograph, The Origins of Siyasa, The Making of Criminal Justice in Early Islam, which covers the development and formation of criminal justice between the 8th and 12th centuries in the Islamic Near East and Mediterranean as an extension of governmental law. So the first period is the Umayyad period, in which secretaries envisioned governmental law as one centered on the caliphate, or the imamate, that the caliph is a source of law through his discretionary judgment. Moving on to the Abbasid period, in which this is a transitional period, which moves away from imamate as the source of this military administrative law to an experimentation of different terminologies, mulk, kingship, tadbir, administration, sultan, governing authority, and then finally siyasa. And then we end this talk with the end of the Abbasid Empire and the rise of non-caliphal rulers such as the Buyids, in which finally siyasa is the name for this military administrative approach. I argue that secretaries, military elites, rulers, viziers, legitimized, desperate, late antique procedures, new military administrative methods, and legal methodologies to legitimize their governance as law. But before we get into this talk, let's just discuss the methodological challenges such a study of Islamic law faces. I hate to say this, but the pre-Ottoman archives are gone. We have no archives for the courts of law. So we have a lacuna of documentary evidence. So we're left with three types of genres. The first is fiqh. And as Christian Lang has observed, they don't reflect historical legal realities. And then we have Adab al-Qadi literature, but the Qadi was not a figure who generally managed these military administrative courts of law. Now we have literary narratives, which actually give reports of cases, but they're embellished because the historians weren't interested in the legal processes. They were interested in these cases as extraordinary events. So they provide a reductive portrayal of these legal processes. So we're left with the writings of left behind by the men behind this administration. Egyptian papyri, our oldest legal records, mayors for princes, administrative manuals, and investor diploma. And these genres start in the Umayyad period. In the first half of the 8th century, the Umayyad caliph, Abd al-Malik bin Marwan, made a momentous decision that Arabic would now be the language of the empire, transforming a bureaucracy that had been based previously on late Koine Greek of the late antique Eastern Romans and Middle Persian of the Sasanian Persians. So these secretarial classes started a process of not only translating these administrative procedures, but adapting them, creating for the first time an administrative language in Arabic. How did they do this? They went into the administrative bureaus and adapted late antique procedures, like the Eastern Roman one of the rescript, toqiyah. So how is this? The rescript was an Eastern Roman procedure in which petitioners who weren't satisfied with lower courts of law could petition higher governing authorities, such as the emperors and caliphs. And these were brought into the Islamic Arab legal milieu. The Umayyad Chancery also translated late antique political treatises, such as the Letter of Tansar Name, Ahd Ardashir, Testament of Ardashir, supposed to be composed by the founder of the Sasanian Empire, but really just composed in the 6th century. And when I say translate, I don't mean line by line. They actually do something more creative. They inject their ideas. So they can present these works and say, oh, these are previous rulers, but it's actually their own ideas. And then finally, the epistolary novel. made up of letters of Pseudo-Aristotle and Alexander the Great, composed in the Eastern Roman period. This led to a transmission of notions of expansive legal authority, which Umayyad secretaries used to develop political theologies to legitimize the caliph as a source of law. But there was also new maxims introduced, such as in the Testament of Ardashir, Mulk with Deen, kingship and religion are twin brothers, separate and intertwined. And this will shape political legal thought, as we will see later. From this political administrative wellspring, Umayyad secretaries developed from these desperate late antique procedures and these military administrative methods, norms and procedures for the caliphate. And the one who did this was, but before we get into the mayors for princes, let's start with how they adapted Roman legal procedures. So this is a papyri from Qurra ibn Sharik, the first governor of Egypt after Abd al-Malik's reform. So I have in the handout I presented to you, you'll see two types of procedures. First, that he states to his provincial Christian deputy, Basil, go and arrest a fugitive. So we're seeing an inquisitorial approach that's different from the inquisitorial approach of the Qadi, in which cases are brought to him. And then he says, if you can't find this fugitive, arrest his son or sons, and if not, his wife. And if not his wife, his head of the village. This is against fiqh. You're not supposed to arrest dependents or relatives or friends for the sins of another, but, you know, all fair in administrative law, right? But there's another procedure as well. Qurra ibn Sharik tells Basil, I've sent to various districts bikitabat with notices of the fugitive's name, his father's name, and his village. They're using census reports to create criminal reports. So you're seeing this adaption of Roman legal procedures. Now, Patricia Crone, in her work on a Roman law, tried to prove that fiqh is actually from Roman law. But what she should have done is shown how military administrative law is derived from late antique legal practices. But another genre was also created, the mayors for princes in Arabic. The father of Arabic political prose, Abd al-Hamid al-Katib, was the last head of the Umayyad chancery. He wrote the first Arabic mayor for princes and also one called the Letter to the Secretaries that established the classification of secretaries and their identities. He states to them, by your tadbir, administration, and siyasa, governance, God renders the sultan of the rulers and governors righteous, accumulates their wealth. Hence your position among them is to be their ears from which they listen, their eyes from which they see, their tongues from which they utter, and their hands from which they strike. So Abd al-Hamid is identifying the scribes as essential to the administration of law, and that the rulers cannot do governance without them. But he also wrote the first Arabic mayor for princes, for the last Umayyad caliph, Marwan II's son, Abdullah. And in this, he counsels them on administration of law and governance, and it's the first earliest treatise on institutions of early Islamic law. So there's a passage here on the Sahib al-Shurta, who will later become the administrator of criminal justice. And he states that the crown prince, the caliph, has to have the Sahib al-Shurta or any military commander investigate cases of slander of courtiers. Or it could be of military soldiers or matters of public order, that they have to interview these members of the courtiers and collect this information and bring it back to the caliph, where he will base it on this information, this righteous information, to implement discretionary judgment. So what are we seeing? We're seeing a military administrative approach, which Abd al-Hamid is elucidating, which is an intertwining of caliphal law and military justice. But there's something interesting about these passages, if you notice. There's no mention of the Quran, nor of the Sunnah, or Sharia. For us to get those terminologies, we have to turn on his passages on the Qadi. So on his passages on the Qadi, he states that the Qadi doesn't rely on the caliph as a source of law. and he actually has to adhere to the Quran, Sunnah, and Sharia. At the same time, he relies on an inquisitorial approach. There's none of the investigative powers we see with the Sahib Ashraful. So in comparing both of these passages, what do we see? That Abd al-Hamid was able to, through these diverse military administrative methods, formulate legal norms and procedures through an administrative lens. Based on the papyri and these passages on the Shurta, the governor and the Sahib al-Shurta depended on an inquisitorial approach based on his high rank and his role as an extension of the caliph's discretionary judgment. In contrast, the Qadi, using an inquisitorial approach, adhered to Quran, Sharia, as well as Sunnah. Sunnah being the religious traditions based on the words and actions of the Prophet and his companions. Now, there's something very interesting. The Sahib al-Shurta and the Qadi are military officers at this point in time. That will soon change in the advent of the Abbasid period. So what starts by what Abd al-Hamid describes is two distinct legal approaches in this hierarchy of military administration under the Amir Mu'mineen, which, if you see the term, means commander of the faithful. He's head of this military administrative hierarchy. But as the Umayyad Empire falls, these two distinct legal approaches would become an institutional and normative separation. So the Abbasids succeed in toppling the Umayyads. They inherit an empire stretching from eastern Iran to North Africa. But they can't rest on their laurels yet. They face momentous legal and urban challenges. In the reign of Abd al-Malik Marwan, after multiple rebellions from Iraq, the Umayyads decide to demilitarize the garrison towns of Basra and Kufa. But inadvertently, those, without the focus on the military, those two garrison towns became cosmopolitan cities. And with it, the rise of the ulama, religious scholarly classes, who the populace saw as the ultimate authorities of religion and law. Through their interpretation of the Quran, Sunnah, and the legal opinions of their masters, they formed schools of law, thus challenging the expansive legal authority of the caliph. And the Abbasid secretary, Ibn al-Muqaffa, in his Risala fi Sahaba, warns the second Abbasid caliph, al-Mansur, of the danger posed by these ulama, stating in your handout that when we maintain that obedience should be given to the imams on certain things and not others, this view is based on discretion, administration, and the authority that God has left in the hands of the imams. No one has the authority to judge in waging war, in amassing wealth, in employing and dismissals, or in cases in which there is no existing precedent for the application of the hudud prescribed penalties and the ordinances. So what does this mean? This means that Ibn Muqaffa is continuing the military administrative framework that Abd al-Hamid has established, but he's restricting its scope now with the rise of fiqh. Now, Ibn Muqaffa actually makes an interesting idea. He tells al-Mansur, why don't you create a book of law like the Justinian Code or the Sasanian Book of Thousand Judgments? Use your discretionary judgment and judge all these opinions of these jurists. But the Abbasids don't take that route. Instead, what they do is they create a separation. Criminal justice would not be in the hands of the Qadi anymore. It would be under military elites, the Shurta. And you see this in the work of the first Muslim chief judge, Abu Yusuf, in his Kitab al-Kharaj, which he wrote for Harun al-Rashid, in which he tries to align these administrative legal systems with fiqh, and he complains about criminal justice. He criticizes the mass incarceration, the use of excessive whippings, coercive interrogations. But I argue that the caliphs and their military elites were just continuing the systems that had existed in the Umayyads. Instead of using them for rebels or challengers to their authority, now they were using them for urban crime. At the same time, the Abbasids also incorporated a Sasanian legal institution, the Madhalim, that would not be in the hands of the Qadi, but under the Caliph, the Vizier, and the Sahib Ashurta. So what do we see? We see two branches of law being created. One based on law as governing authority, and one on religious knowledge. So let's skip 150 years now. Building on Abdulhamid's work, Abbasid secretaries wrote administrative manuals with chapters dedicated to courts of law, particularly the administrative courts. The most significant of these are the ones by Qudama ibn Ja'far, Kitab al-Khuraj wa Sina'at al-Kitaba, and al-Burhan fi Wujuh al-Bayan by the Abbasid secretary Ibn Wahb, and then the most significant text, Siyasat al-Muluk, written by an anonymous Abbasid secretary in the beginning of the 10th century. And Ibn Wahb says something very interesting, that all of these courts of law, the Qadi, the Madalim, and the Shurta, are all divided according to their hukum, jurisdiction. He says the Qadi relies on witness testimony, the Madalim on interviewing virtuous men from the elites and the neighborhoods, and the Sahib al-Shurta utilizing reasonable suspicion, rooted in social hierarchical classifications and criminal reports, and extracts confessions through intimidation, whippings, and imprisonment in opposition to fiqh. And he also has to use cunning means as well. I don't know, like play some games or something, who knows, you know? But also in the Siyasat al-Muluk, he states that the vizier and the Sahib al-Shurta don't have to rely on witnesses, just on spies and informants, to collect information that they can use as evidence to prosecute cases. So we're seeing this continuation of these military administrative procedures that are rooted in late antiquity as well as the creativity of the secretaries. But also, there is all the juridical process which is done through petitions, just like the Eastern Roman period. So in your handout, Qudama ibn Ja'far describes how the juridical process is for the Madalim. That the Sahib al-Madalim, which is usually the vizier, collects the petitions of the plaintiffs and presents it every Friday to the caliph. The caliph, presiding over the people, will write on each petition, if he has endurance, which means he probably wasn't there most of the time anyway, you know? He writes on the back of the petition, a rescript, tawqi', Eastern Roman procedure, his judgment. And, or if a dossier is given by the Sahib al-Diwan al-Madalim for him to read, so if it's a very complicated case. And then these petitions are brought back to the plaintiffs, and the copies of these petitions and the dossiers are put in the Diwan al-Madalim, the archives. This is not as arbitrary as Emil Tayyan makes it out to be. This is a very complicated administrative system. But also, and also just to note, Caliph Allah as well, still existing in this period, that the caliph has to be a source of law. But this system also continues with the court of the Shurta. Ibn Wahb describes in his chapter on the Sahib al-Shurta that people, friends or relatives of prisoners in who were accused of crimes or were criminals can write petitions to the Majlis al-Shurta. And so Ibn Wahb advises that that each district commander, so just to explain that in Baghdad, the criminal administrative system was a five-strata system. You had the Sahib al-Shurta on top, two lieutenants on the eastern and western side of the city, and then on each, every single district is a commander. And then under them are commanders of the watch. So he states that the military clerk of the district has to write the petitions for each district or the ones brought by the commander of the watch. And this is brought by the Sahib al-Shurta every Friday. So Friday is judgment day, apparently, you know? And this is brought to the emir or the imam, a higher governing authority. And so he writes on the petition, under the mention of any name, what was the judgment? Whether it's release or discipline, a discretionary judgment, or the hudud, prescribed penalties, or qisas talian. And he states that only the imam can write judgments for the prescribed penalties and discretion. So Caliph Allah, even in this complicated military administration, still exists, albeit a bit diminished. And then the Sahib al-Shurta has to transcribe these petitions and dossiers and other documents in the Diwan al-Shurta, the archive as well. So you see kind of this evolution of all these military administrative procedures and norms throughout the two centuries. But it's not just legal practice that's different from the Sharia courts. It's also the sources of law. Ibn Wahb states that all the administrative protocols is from the senior members of the bureaucracy. So it's all about administrative continuity. The author of the Siyasat al-Muluk states that the Sahab al-Shurta and the Wazir have to read the Kutub Ashab al-Shurta wal-Wuzara, as well as Siyar al-Muluk as well. So these are administrative notebooks with information on the actions of previous commanders of the Shurta, viziers, and kings. So you see something that's an alternative to the Sunnah as well, that these secretaries and these officials have their own traditions. And Qudama ibn Ja'far speaks about ilm al-siyasa, the science of governance, based on the perspective of knowledge of administrators. So since the time of Abd al-Hamid, the Abbasid secretaries have standardized the norms of procedures that have been founded in the Umayyad period. But in the first half of the 10th century, the caliphal authority had declined. It was in the hands of military and bureaucratic elites and would be soon conquered by non-caliphal rulers who would put a name to this military administrative law, siyasa. But before we get into that, I want to get into the experimentation that's happening throughout these centuries and how this leads to an epistemology. So we have the first branch coming down from the ra'i, discretionary judgment of the caliph. This is the one that established by Abd al-Hamid. But by the mid-9th century, it's being referred to as Tadbir al-Khilafa. So now it's more about the administrative protocols than the personal authority of the caliph as a source of law. And then by the first half of the 10th century, Sultan, that governors can also be sources of law alongside the caliphs, as well as non-caliphal rulers. But we also have another branch from what I mentioned previously, the testament of Ardashir, Mulk al-Din. But by the mid-9th century, and Kitab al-Taj, written by a secretary for the Abbasid Caliph al-Mutawakkil, states that Siyasat al-Muluk, or Siyasat al-Muluk, is distinct from Sharia. So you see an evolution of this adapted Sasanian dichotomy. And then by the first half of the 10th century, Ibn Wahb states Sultan al-Din. Qudama ibn Ja'far says, Dabt, political control versus Sharia, Islamic law, as well. And this would all eventually culminate in the Buyid period with Ahkam al-Siyasa versus Sharia. So under the Buyids, viziers, military elites, secretaries, would refer to military methods, the protocols of viziers, criminal procedures, all encompassed by Siyasa. Abu Hayyan al-Tawhidi, a Buyid courtier who served Ibn Sa'adan, a Buyid vizier, states in a majlis that there are two branches of law, Ahkam al-Siyasa and Sunan al-Din. One is earthly, the other one is heavenly. And that secretaries and rulers and officials need to study the Kutub al-Siyasa. Treatises that I argued in my article started from Abd al-Hamid, a military administrative genealogy, that for them to understand this source of law. The Abbasid Buyid judge, At-Tunuhi, states that a katib of the Sahib al-Shurta has to know five sources of criminal law. Qisas, tallying; hudud, prescribed penalties; jirahat, wounds; mu'athibat, assaults; and siyasat, procedures, as well. So clearly, siyasa won out. But why? Why was it picked over mulk, tadbir, sultan, or the ra'i of the khalifa? Because siyasa is versatile. See, mulk doesn't really work for caliphs, right? Tadbir, that's just for the secretaries, you know? Sultan, that's not high enough, you know? But siyasa has always existed. Governance can encompass all these non-fiqh procedures and authorities of officials and rulers. And Abu Hayyan al-Tawhidi and Miskawi in a book state that the siyasa and muluk existed alongside the sharia of the anbiya as well. So it existed since time immemorial as well. There's always been these two branches of law. So, in conclusion, what am I trying to establish through all this? A new framework for examining this early history of Islamic law. In the 7th century, Muslim Arab caliphs took over territories in the Near East and Mediterranean, where late antique Sasanian and Eastern Roman legal notions were prevalent and various procedures remained in practice. By the reign of the 8th century, the Umayyad Caliph Abd al-Malik bin Marwan, the Kutab, secretarial classes, notably including Abd al-Hamid al-Katib, began to form an Arabic administrative language of law. This collective project drew from the political theologies of Umayyad discourse and translated texts, diverse late antique practices, and military administrative methods of the caliphate, resulting in the creation of a military administrative law that established new forms and procedures outside of fiqh. This development in the first half of the 8th century coincided with the rise of fiqh, Islamic jurisprudence, which influenced the judiciary and led to the emergence of two distinct legal approaches, one associated with the caliph and their agents and secretaries, and the other with the ulama and the judiciary. By the time of the Abbasid caliphs, a clear separation had been established between the military administrative courts of law, the shurta and the madalim, and the ones by the sharia courts of the judiciary. By the first half of the 10th century, the Abbasid secretaries had standardized the norms and procedures formed in the Umayyad period, with the shurta and madalim having distinct non-fiqh evidentiary procedures and investigative powers. As the caliphate diminished under the Buyids, non-caliphal rulers, emirs, sultans, viziers, military elites, and secretaries, and even judges, identified this military administrative law with a name, siyasa, governance, which encompassed all non-fiqh practices and authority. Thus, the study of siyasa offers a more nuanced and pluralistic understanding of Islamic law compared to fiqh-centric perspectives. It adds depth to ongoing debates about what constitutes Islamic law and whether non-fiqh laws can be considered Islamic law. The emergence of government law and its subsequent legitimization under the rubric of siyasa illustrates the Islamic administrative legal thought and praxis that had their own genealogy beyond fiqh, driven by the everyday demands of criminal justice and the court of redress, which were rationalized by secretaries who acted as legal theorists, counterparts to the jurists. Throughout these centuries, in the history of government law has been established by rulers, military elites, and secretaries who played all a significant role in contributing to Islamic law. Thank you.